Let's take our Bibles, go to Genesis chapter 37. The King is coming. What a great, great truth. What a glorious truth. The Mount of Olives in Jerusalem is the mount of His coming. The prophet Zechariah said twice He would come. The first time He would come, lowly, riding on a colt. And He rode on that colt down the Mount of Olives into the city of Jerusalem. The Bible says just a couple chapters later in Zechariah, that same king will come again. And His feet will touch the Mount of Olives. And He will then walk through the eastern gate and rule and reign as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I couldn't agree with the song more. The King is coming. And we get to live in these days in preparation for it. What a joy, what a blessing. Man, I'm excited to be back in Genesis, okay? So Genesis 37. Now, I want to give you just a little review before I read and get caught up. So Genesis is the story of how everything began. God gives us two major things that He started in the book of Genesis. The first thing is, of course, He started the whole world. He created the heavens and the earth in the book of Genesis. And the origins of the world, the universe, stars, skies, earth, heavens, is all found in the book of Genesis in chapters 1 and 2. Then the Bible tells us about the beginnings or the origins of the nation of Israel. And that begins in chapter number 11 and goes all the way through the end of the book. That is significant mainly for one reason. It is significant because it was going to be through Israel in a specific land, through a specific people, at a specific time in the future, that Christ was going to be born. So the significant thing about Israel is that God was going to use this small nation in the Middle East to bring forth His son Jesus. So that's the storyline. In fact, that's the storyline of the entire Bible. Now in Genesis 11 through 50, the Bible tells us that this nation, Israel, was founded upon patriarchs or forefathers, the origins of the nation, beginning with Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob. And then Jacob, of course, had 12 sons. That's where we are in the story. In fact, Jacob is still with us. In fact, he's at the end of chapter number 37, but he's no longer the central figure of the story. The central figure becomes Joseph, but even Joseph has a specific purpose beyond himself. And the purpose for Joseph's life was that God was going to use him to preserve the promises of God through Israel to Judah. Now, when we get to next week, I'm just going to go ahead and warn you, next week is one of those banana stories, okay? I mean, it's going to be, I mean, like the chapter itself is rated PG-12 for sure, okay? So, but why is the Bible doing this? Why is Joseph introduced in chapter 37, Judah is revisited in chapter 38? The answer is that God was still going to fulfill His promise through Judah that the Messiah was going to come, but the way He was going to do that was He was going to use a man by the name of Joseph, Judah's brother, to bring about the preservation of God's promises to Israel. Now, folks, listen, books have been written by the hundreds about Joseph. Movies have been published about Joseph. Broadway shows have been published and produced about Joseph. But the real story is found for us right here in the Bible. And it is a dazzling story. It covers 13 chapters in the book of Genesis. And I've labeled this part of Genesis, Never Forsaken. Because what you're going to find in this story is that Joseph gets knocked down. Joseph gets forgotten about by everybody except God. And if you have ever felt forgotten, or you have ever felt forsaken, or you have ever felt like things weren't working out the way you, watch it, dreamed they would, then there's a message for you. Now I want to begin my reading in Genesis chapter 37. At verse number 1, we'll go through verse number 20. Now, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. He also made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even the more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around it and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and to his brothers, and his fathers rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." Then he said to them, "Please go to see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" He said, "I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said one to another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. Watch this. We shall see what will become of his dreams." Amen. I want to label the message this morning, "A dream no one could kill." You ever had a weird dream? In some ways, all dreams are weird, I guess. I had a weird roommate in college, and he was a crazy dreamer. And the way I know he was a crazy dreamer is because he talked in his dreams. What made matters even more interesting about Jonathan is that Jonathan was from China. And so when he spoke in his dreams, he reverted back to Mandarin. Of course, I had no idea what he was saying or what he was talking about, but he sounded like he was in some Bruce Lee film, okay? I was just sure that he was fending off, you know, ninjas or something like that. It really cracked me up because I was a dormitory leader that semester, and so I would always go and had to make sure all the lights were out in the dorms, and I would always kind of creep back into my room late. So I heard all the kung fu stories every night, and it used to crack me up. And every once a week, we would have a hall leaders meeting where me and the other dorm leaders would meet together with our dorm supervisor, and we would just have our weekly meeting where we would debrief and such. And sometimes we would stay up way later than we needed to, and we were just having a good time one night. If I'm awake after 10 o'clock, I start getting funny, man. Like funny things start happening, and I just can't control myself. And so it was late, probably midnight one night. We're talking, we're all laughing, cracking up. I said, "Guys, you're not going to believe this. Jonathan talks in his sleep in Chinese." "No, I'm telling you, Jonathan talks in his sleep in Chinese. You're lying." I said, "I am not lying. You want to bet?"
Yeah, okay, let's go right now. So me and these other six very mature student leaders in this Christian university tiptoed down the hallway, got to Smith room 107, cracked open the door, snuck in. I mean, you can imagine. Jonathan stayed on the bottom bunk, on the two bunk side of the room, and he had this like flap, you know, like a blanket that he flapped over his bed. And so it was super dark, it was super quiet. I walked in first. All these guys are behind me. So now there's seven of us piled in my dorm room, and we're crowding around Jonathan's bed, and all of a sudden he starts. Now, the funny thing is, for whatever reason this night, he wasn't in Mandarin. He started laughing. And it was like this evil giggle from like a murder movie. Like he had just taken someone's life and was cackling in this evil way. Of course, we start cracking up. But then after that, he leans even further into whatever dream, and he started going, "Bubbles, bubbles," and he starts poking them, and he's talking about, "Oh, purple and pink." And by that time, me and the seven mature guys just lost it, and we hustled out of there as fast as we could. Jonathan was a crazy dreamer. And we look at dreams, and when you look at Genesis chapter 37, it would be very easy for you to equate those kinds of dreams with what's going on here in the Bible. I've heard guys preach about this. Hey, listen, go live a God-given dream. Almost like, go figure out what you want to do and go get it. But that's not what's going on in Genesis chapter 37. It is a dream, but this dream meant much more than just my personal ambition. In fact, this dream was really three things. It was, first of all, a revelation. It was God showing Joseph something he could not have known on his own. Number two, it was a prophecy, meaning this is something that's going to happen. Remember later on in the story when Pharaoh has the dreams and he has two dreams back to back? And when Joseph interprets that dream, he gives him the interpretation and he says, "God showed you this twice, because it will surely come to pass." In the same way, in Genesis chapter 37, when God shows up in these dreams and demonstrates to Joseph through the sheaves and through the stars and the planets bowing down, he's saying this is actually absolutely going to happen. It was a prophecy. There would be a day when Joseph would be bowed down to by his brothers and even his father. That day would come. But not only was it a revelation, and not only was it a prophecy, it was also a promise. It was a promise that Joseph would cling to for many chapters in the Bible as the dream would seem to evaporate before his very eyes. Because although the dream came, which was basically a word from God that formed beliefs in Joseph's heart, that formed faith in Joseph's heart, that formed action in Joseph's life, his brothers, his family, in fact, that were supposed to be these patriarchs, these godly leaders, turned his palace of dreams into a pit of despair. May I say this to you this morning? If you've got visions and dreams from God, I'm talking about words from God. I'm not talking about your own personal ambition. I'm talking about God through his word giving you something that you need to act upon, that you need to live out, that you need to follow. I want to assure you that about the time you get that word from God, from his word, you will have people trying to stand in the way of your dreams. And that's exactly what you find in this story. In fact, I think one thing that really surfaces to the top of this story is that Joseph's family stood to get in the way of his dreams. And I want to say this to you this morning. Folks, listen, a messed up family never messes up God's plan for your life. A messed up family does not have to define your future or change your calling. God can use and give his word to anyone, regardless of their family, regardless of their history, and fulfill his plan for their lives. I remember very vividly when God called me to come to this church. And the way that I knew definitively that God was calling me to this church was through Scripture. In Isaiah chapter 58, verse 12, God gave it to me. I was in Michigan. I was reading through the book of Isaiah, and he gave me this word from the book of Isaiah. They that shall be of these shall raise up the old waste places. Thou shalt be a repairer of the breach and a restorer of the paths to dwell in. Before God, I knew God wanted me to go to a church that needed to be restored, resurrected, fixed, brought up from the dead, so to speak. And I knew that God was calling me to that. Folks, every friend and counselor that I knew told me not to come to this church in Jacksonville, Florida. Every single one of them without fail. So what do you do? How do you know? How do you ascertain that God is calling you to do something? It's very simple. Do you have a word from God? I'm not talking about did God talk to you in some dream, or did God talk to you when you were out, like, you know, doing yoga on a mountain? I'm talking to you. Do you have a word from God? And when God gives a word, you can build your life on this word. You can make your plans on this word. You can build your future on the word. This word is the dream that God has for us today. And I want to tell you today, friend, I want to encourage you to keep dreaming, meaning keep following God no matter what is going on around you. And let me give you three specific ways in which people will try to stop your dreams, in which you must continue to follow God. Number one, I want you to see this. I want to challenge you to do this, and particularly in 2026, dream regardless of family problems. Dream regardless of family problems. I got news for you, friend. Although things have changed in our society and our culture, families have always had issues. There are different issues today. I'm assuming that virtually every one of us in this room, every one of us in this room probably has something in your family you wish you could change. Someone in your family you wish you could change. Some circumstance about your family that you wish you could change. Something in your family's history that you wish you could change. No problem in any family at all can stop you from doing God's will for your life. And this was a particularly messed up family, was it not? I mean, were you listening when I was reading these first 20 verses? You find a family filled with two things that no family should ever be filled with. Number one, this family was filled with enmity. Verses 1 through 4 talk about how much hatred and how much strife there was between Joseph, particularly in his brothers. This is not the kind of family that you would hope to see, expect to see. It's certainly not a family you would enjoy if you were a part of. Maybe you're a part of a family like that. Maybe there's some deep-seated hate between you and a parent, or you and a sibling, or you and a cousin, or you and someone like a grandparent who maybe did things, said things in a way that has caused there to be division and enmity or enemies in your own home. Proverbs 12 and 10 verse 12 says, hatred stirs up strife. Proverbs 26, 24, whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors in his heart deceit. 1 John, listen to this, chapter 2, verse 9 says, whoever says he is in light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Can I say this? From a Christian perspective, there is no place for hatred and unresolved anger in the life of a believer. And maybe if it's not in your own heart, maybe something even worse, that you've allowed somebody else's anger and hatred and enmity of you to actually slow you down or stop you from doing what God has for you. This is not an ideal situation. In fact, not only is it not ideal because it was a family filled with enmity, it was secondly a family filled with envy. And notice in verse 5, it starts, it says this, Joseph had a dream and they hated him even the more. This is repeated over and over and over again. Why did they hate Joseph? They hated him for two reasons. Number one, they hated him because his dad favored Joseph, and that's always a bad idea. Favoritism in a family will create problems. In fact, I might say it like this, envy can be created. Other people can do things or say things that will create envy in someone. Envy not only can be created, but envy also can be gotten through comparison. Not only did they hate their brother and envy their brother because of their dad, they also had to compare themselves to him via these dreams. I mean, in these dreams, basically Joseph says, okay, there were 13 bundles of sheaves. This is, you know, gathered grain, sheaved up in a bundle. Think haystack, I guess. Here they are, gathered in a bundle, and all the rest bow to him. The next one is about stars and planets bowing to him. What does that mean? It puts them in an inferior position, at least in their mind, to Joseph. So what does that do? It causes comparison. They were looking at God's plan for Joseph and looking at God's plan for them, and they didn't like the plan for them. They wanted the plan for him. Doesn't that sound like Peter and John in John chapter number 21? Whenever Peter is engaged in this conversation with Jesus, and Jesus saying, man, if you love me, feed my sheep. If you love me, attend to my lambs. If you love me, follow my call on your life. You're going to follow me, and one day you're going to die for me. Peter, are you in or out? You know what Peter says? What about him? You know what God says? You don't worry about him. You just decide if you're going to follow me. Boy, how many people can get eaten up with envy as they compare their lives, compare themselves to other people and what they have or what they perceive they have. You see, envy is through creation. Envious is through comparison. But I want to tell you this, envy can be cancerous. Listen to this, Proverbs 14, verse 30. A tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes rotten bones. James chapter 3, verse 16 says, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. The Bible is very clear that envy, jealousy that seeks harm on others, is a cancer that doesn't destroy the person envied, but destroys the person doing the envying. It's like drinking poison, hoping somebody else is going to die. This is a bad way to live. Folks, listen. I just want to say on this last Sunday of 2025, there is not a person in this room that doesn't have life better than you deserve or better than you should. And to spend your life comparing yourself to everybody else, feeling like everybody else has it better than you, letting that eat you on the inside and wreck every relationship God could give you, is an absolute disastrous way to live. Your family may describe you, but it does not have to define you. If that were true, we would never know of a woman named Oprah Winfrey. I'm not defending anything she is or believes, but I think we'd all agree she's, to the world's standards, successful. Do you know she came from a broken home? In fact, she came from a shattered home. Do you know she was born into poverty, raised in instability? Do you know that she was abused as a child? She was pregnant at age 14 and lost her baby. She was passed around like a football between family members who altogether could not protect her. A family that was supposed to be a covering actually turned into chaos. And yet, she did not just survive that experience. Yes, she thrived from that experience and did not let her past excuse her, but went on in spite of what she went through. The dysfunction of your family does not disqualify your destiny. Folks, listen, God does not require a perfect family for a faithful future. Let me say it like this. God often births deliverers out of difficult domestic soil. If you do not have a great family, if you do not have a great background, you are joining the ranks of lots of people in the Bible and throughout history that made it anyway. And friend, you need to leave your excuse at the threshold of 2026 and say, I am not going to let somebody else, even in my family, define how I dream of and follow Christ with my life. Not only do we see that you need to dream on regardless of family problems, but I would say, secondly, you need to dream on regardless of man's plots. You see, beginning in verse number 12, we see a plot. And the plot is when Israel, or Jacob, asked Joseph to go see or visit his brothers. That's verses 12 through 16. Joseph goes to where he thinks they were supposed to be, and even though they were supposed to be there, they weren't there. Shock. The man who had interacted with them heard their plans. They went to another city called Dothan, so they go there. Notice verse number 18. And when they saw him afar off, even before they came near, they conspired against him to kill him. Can I just say this? This is an evil plot. What an awful thing to think. What an awful thing to do. Like, it's one thing to think something. It's another thing to say something. And then it's another thing to actually act upon what you think and say. You find these brothers going through all three phases. They think it, then they say it, then they do it. What do? Well, ultimately, you probably know this. The first thought was, let's just kill the guy. Verse number 18, they conspired against him to kill him. Look at verse number 21. But Reuben heard it. This is like the only admirable thing Reuben ever does with his whole life. Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. Reuben said, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him. Let's just throw him in the pit. I think what he's saying at this point, let's just mess with him. Let's just give him the worst day of his life. We don't want to kill him. That'd be blood on our hands. Let's just throw him in the pit. But watch this. Verse 23. So it came to pass when they had come close, when Joseph had come close to his brothers, they stripped him of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. They took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. Now watch this. Watch how evil these guys are. Verse number 25. They sat down to eat a meal. I mean, it's one thing to be that demonic that you would think about killing your brother, then just throw him in a pit. It says there was no water, meaning there was no way to be sustained in there. This was just an emptied out well, probably. I'm sure it was probably painful as they look at it, cast him in there. That probably wasn't real pleasant. I doubt that they lowered him down on a rope. But then to make matters worse, to like show you just how evil these guys were, they sat down and had lunch right after they threw their brother in that pit. All of a sudden, Joseph's dreams go to the pits. But it even gets worse. They didn't kill him. They throw him in the pit. But watch this. At the middle part of verse 24, they lifted up their eyes while they were eating and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them into Egypt. So Judah says, here's Judah again. And we're going to see more about him next week. Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Now, all of you know that Joseph ends up in Egypt. Ultimately, this is how he got there. Now, think of how awful this is. It is an evil plot. We don't want to kill him. Why? Because we can't get anything out of this. You talk about depths of evil. These guys are absolutely the face of evil. What are we going to get if we kill him? No. Let's sell him as a slave into the Ishmaelite hands, and they will take him into Egypt, and they'll sell him to the Egyptians, no doubt, just like they're going to sell this myrrh and all these other spices. To them, he was just an object. By the way, anytime any person ever treats another person like nothing more than an object, things become very evil. This is how abortions take place. This is how rapes take place. When you start viewing people as objects, the only thing that you can get out of that person is some benefit for you. This is the heart of evil, folks. It was an evil plot, but not only was it an evil plot, it was a deceptive plot. So look at verse number 29. So Reuben returns. Reuben, I don't know where Reuben went, but Reuben comes back. And indeed, Joseph was not in the pit. He tears his clothes. It was a sign of brokenness and sorrow. He returned, verse 30, to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, watch this, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? See the deception? So they sell him into slavery. Now they've got to come up with a cover story. By the way, that's the way sin always is in someone's life. Evil always has to have a cover story. Evil has to have a way of glossing over things. I mean, think about this. They sold their brother in slavery. Now they're going to act like he's dead. They're going to take his coat. They're going to tear it up. They're going to dip it in this animal's blood. Now they're going to take it back to dad and go, hey, does this look like Joseph's? This is deceptive. Folks, listen, there's always someone who has something they are trying to accomplish, and oftentimes they will use people. Sometimes you may have been the recipient of this. Reminds me of the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II. There were high-ranking military leaders in World War II that believed that black pilots should never fly combat missions. And so some quietly set them up for failure by giving them fewer resources, assigning them older aircrafts, and placing them under harsher scrutiny, expecting they would fail and crash, and failure in their mind would prove that these men did not belong. But their plan backfired. They became one of the most successful fighter escort groups of the world, protecting bombers with an unmatched record. That's the story of Joseph, and that can be your story too. Man can have all the plans they want, but man's plans do not overthrow God's will for your life. Think about this, Proverbs 19:21. Many are the plans in man's heart, but the Lord's purpose will prevail. Proverbs 21:30, no wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against the Lord. Psalm 33, verse 10, the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the people. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. I'm here to tell you, there is a greater rule, there is a greater word, there is a greater plan, and there is a greater purpose that no one can stop, and that is God. So get this, do not let them stop you. Dream, regardless of family problems, dream, regardless of man's plots. Finally, dream, regardless of your pain. Verse 33, he recognized it. That's Jacob, excuse me. He recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without a doubt, Joseph is torn in pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days, and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. Watch this. But he refused to be comforted. For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. There's two kinds of pain I see in this passage. One is Joseph's pain. Now, did you recall how old Joseph was back in 17. 17. Can you imagine being 17, being thrown into a pit by your brothers, then being sold into the hands of Ishmaelites that likely did not speak your language? You are now walking like a slave in chains down to Egypt. You have no idea what is in your future. Can you just imagine? Maybe Joseph wondered if those dreams were actually going to come true. Have you ever been through some personal pain, some loss, some disappointment that caused deep pain in your heart? Just feel his pain increase with every step of his sandals in the burning sand of the Israeli wilderness going down to Egypt. But then there's another pain. It's the pain of someone who feels like something's lost, watch this, with no hope of it ever turning around. And that's Jacob. The loss of a son with no hope. Think about this. In 1996, there was a Mount Everest expedition led by Dr. Beck Weathers. And during this expedition, a massive storm hit near the summit. Beck Weathers collapsed in the storms. His teammates found him later when the storm passed, and they saw him. They checked on him. He was unconscious. They thought frozen, had no signs of life. They made the decision no one wanted to make, but they had to descend, and they left him there. His wife was notified that he was dead. His team and the camp thought he was dead. The whole world thought he was dead. But he wasn't. Hours later, in sub-zero temperatures, he regained consciousness. Although severely injured, blinded, and severely frostbitten, he was alive and somehow actually made it back. He survived. He lost some of his fingers. He lost one of his hands. He even lost parts of his face in frostbite, but he did come back. He did make it, wrote a book about it, became a speaker and a prolific author. You see, at this stage, listen, at this stage right now in this story, all hope is gone. Similar to disciples standing at the foot of the cross when Jesus was beaten and tortured and suffered and died, and the Bible says, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen. And if Christ is not risen, then our preaching is empty. Our faith is also empty. Yes, we are found false witnesses of God because we have said that God has been raised, has raised up Jesus from the dead. For if the dead do not rise, then Christ is not risen. And if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. Then only those who have fallen asleep in Christ have perished. Listen to this. If in this life only we have hope, we are of all men most pitiable. One of the greatest pains a person will ever experience in their life is when they are faced, when they have faced eternity with no certainty of the resurrection. It is a pain that is coupled with fear and hopelessness. Friend, I want you to just know today, if you face death that way, there is an answer for you. Because Jesus Christ raised from the dead, death is not the end for those that have put their faith and trust in him. You do not have to face death as the ultimate peril, but as an opportunity for you to be absent in the body and to be present with the Lord. The fact of the matter is, for a believer, listen, for a believer, hope is often buried prematurely. Through the resurrection and through the story of Joseph, we can learn this. Some people may say it's over, but God never says it's over. Your life is not ever written off while God is still writing your plan. Hopelessness, therefore, for a believer is a misdiagnosis. Because the final chapter is not sung, the final hymn, or written, and the final hymn has not been sung. Just because you see no evidence of hope does not mean there is no existence of hope. So you may be going through some pain at the end of 2025. You may have experienced loss for the first time. You may have just gone through your first season of the holidays grieving loss, grieving brokenness, grieving shatteredness. Listen very carefully. Here you are. Here you are. Back in church, another Sunday, another opportunity, staring right at the doorstep of a brand new year. Hope is a misdiagnosis. Hopelessness is a misdiagnosis. Let me encourage you. Look to Christ. No matter what pain is going on, no matter what has happened to you in your life, no matter what has happened to you, do not give up on hope.